Well, thank you, Father, for inviting me again. I always enjoy coming out here. It's being in Canada is very beautiful up here, and it's nice to have this Arctic weather that you're experiencing compared to Houston. You can sometimes forget that you're not in the United States as an American being up here, but then you see things that remind you, like Sir Winston Churchill High School or something like that. You never see that in the United States. But it's good to be here. Those of you that were at the talk on Friday, I went into some detail about how evangelicalism has been imploding, but I would say that even beyond that, especially since the COVID lockdowns and a lot of the things that happened after that, a lot of people have woken up to the fact that so much of what we see in our society is fake, a lot of the institutions that they thought that they could trust, they came to realize that they couldn't trust, and that's both secular and religious institutions. And so we have people coming in mass into the Orthodox Church. I know that it's not the same dynamic in Canada, but I know from talking to Father Jeffrey, just hearing how many catechumens he has in his parish, that at least to some extent it's happening here too. There are probably different reasons why it might be at a bigger rate in the United States. But we have an open door. We have a great opportunity. And when you have a great opportunity, what you don't want to do is squander it by not taking advantage of it. So I think that we have to have an intentional approach to how we're trying to reach out to people and to build on this dynamic that we're experiencing. When I first became Orthodox, it was in Oklahoma City, as Father mentioned, but I grew up more or less in Houston after 1978. So after 2 years after I converted, we moved back to Houston. At that time, there was only one Rocor parish in the state of Texas. Now I think we're up to 12. And a lot of those have only been established like in the last, 5 years or so. And so the dynamic of increase has been accelerating. The Antiochians, even the Greek Archdiocese, which I'm no slam on the Greeks, but the Greeks tend to be a little bit more ethnically focused than the other jurisdictions. And so in the past, they've not had big influxes of converts other than people marrying Greeks and stuff like that. But even Greek parishes are inundated right now with catechumens. And we have a good clergy association in the Houston area, and so I hear what the various clergy have to say about what's going on, and I hear this from everyone. And I'm really good friends with Father Joseph Honeycutt, who's the pastor of St. Joseph's on the west side of Houston, which is an Antiochian church. That church has been so inundated that about 3 years ago they started doing, maybe it was 4 years ago, but they started doing two liturgies on Sunday. But the Antiochians have a very wise rule that says if you have to do two liturgies on Sunday, you also have to start working on starting a new mission. So they started a new mission in Richmond, Texas, which is sort of to the south west of Houston, and named after St. Thecla. And that's already a parish now. It's not just a struggling mission that's having 50 people. They've got well over 100 people, maybe closer to two, and they're in a very large storefront, and they're trying to buy property. The property values are one of the hurdles that we have, because unfortunately, the value of the dollar and the value of real estate are going in opposite directions, and so it's making it difficult. But in the Houston area, just in the last couple of years, I believe we've had five missions that have gotten started. There's several that are in the works right now. My own parish was able to start one to the north of Houston, about an hour to the north of where we're at. First liturgy, which we were only able to do on a Saturday, we had, I believe, 58 people commune. So, compared to missions of the past, when I started St. Jonah's, I wished that we'd had 58 people in total for many years, and it took us a long time to get there. Father Moses McPherson, you probably heard of him. he took over the parish that he is now the rector of when they had a house church that could accommodate maybe 40 people. He bought the property that they're using now, and he happened to sell the current church, I mean the original house church, right when the market was going at its peak. And so they made so much money off the sale of that property, they were almost able to pay off the mortgage on this new property, which had a Protestant church on it. Since then, he's bought a 20-acre piece of property that has a mansion on it. They're working on building a church. And rather than sell the current church, they're going to have two parishes. So this is something that we're seeing all over the place. If you want to know where we're headed, you need to take some time to think about how we got to where we're at. And obviously, there's the exterior dynamics that I think have made a lot of people interested in Orthodoxy. The internet certainly has helped, because it's so easy now for people to find out about Orthodoxy. But if we had not had people in the past that paved the way for us to be where we're at, there wouldn't have been any of this infrastructure in place to make it possible for people to convert. We know about people like Philip Ludwell III, who we discovered we didn't know about. He was a historical figure before the American Revolution, but he was actually the first convert to Orthodoxy, come to find out, because someone did some research and discovered this. And he was friends with George Washington. I think George Washington courted one of his daughters, but his daughter married a Greek Orthodox Christian, not coincidentally. So probably dad had something to do with that. But he did some of the earliest translations into English. As a matter of fact, I wanted to read the Confession of St. Peter Mogila and ordered it on Amazon. And when I got it, I was reading the introduction, and it was translated by Philip Ludwell III. They spell his name very strangely, but when you read the biography of him, and it's very short, but just no doubt about who it is. And so this translation is still being used. In Texas, it's one of the oldest parishes in the lower 48 states. St. Constantine and Helen Galveston was established during the American Civil War as a lay community, but they petitioned the Tsar to send them a priest in the late 1800s, I think it was maybe 1890 or something like that. And so Tsar Nicholas sent his Greek tutor to be the priest, who was 60 years old. So he began being a missionary at the age of 60, and he could speak Russian, he could speak Greek, and the parish mostly consisted of Greeks and Serbs with some Russians. And he wound up doing missionary work, traveling by wagon in many cases all over much of the United States, looking for Orthodox Christians that had settled in various places. And Father Seraphim Rose, he's going to be made a saint soon, from what we're hearing. And here's a man who explored all kinds of different religions, had experienced. Basically, he came of age when America was kind of at its peak in terms of its prosperity and social cohesion and all that, right after World War II, and then was part of it as it started to go downhill morally and spiritually. And he was a part of all that and got caught up in all kinds of different religious explorations, as well as the moral decadence that was became very popular in the 50s and the 60s. But he was a linguistic genius, and he walked in, he was invited to come to the San Francisco Cathedral, and it was all in Slavonic and Russian. And most of us, if that was our experience, we would say, well, that's a pretty church, but it's not for me. I didn't understand anything that they said. But he was such a linguistic genius that he just decided, well, I'll learn Russian, I'll learn Slavonic, and had no problem doing that. And he did tons of translations that we have in English today, and also helped to evangelize all kinds of people, because we had different waves of conversion that started in big numbers, I would say, in the 80s and 90s, but it's just snowballed ever since then. But you had people who were doing this long before most of those people even thought about becoming Orthodox, and he was one of those people. Father Peter Gilchrist in the 80s took a whole group of people who were involved in Campus Crusade for Christ and did a lot of evangelism to bring people into the Orthodox Church. He was probably the driving force behind getting the Orthodox Study Bible published. And in terms of contemporary figures, we have people online that have done a great deal of work. And I know that there's a lot of people who think when you hear the name Jay Dyer, that, you know, he's the devil or something like that, because he sometimes says unkind things to people. I know from asking people that walk into my church, and I have probably three or four new people, individuals or families, every Sunday. They don't all stay because we've run out of room. We're working on that. But we have a ton of new people constantly coming through our church, and I'll always ask them, how did you find out about Orthodoxy? And I would say Jay Dyer's name comes up probably 80% of the time. And there's just no denying that he's had a huge impact on bringing people to the church. And how does he do it? I think that the secret that he's had is that he talks about things other than Orthodoxy. He talks about a lot of cultural issues. He talks about movies. He talks about music. People watch his podcast because maybe they watched a movie and they liked it, and they see he's talking about it, and they want to see what he's got to say. But then he starts talking about Orthodoxy, and they're still watching. They follow his channel, and then they start going down the rabbit trail into the Orthodox faith. I think that that's great. One big phenomenon we have now is that before people even step foot in the Orthodox Church, many of them have already self-catechized themselves, not always properly, but at least they have a lot of an idea of what it is that Orthodoxy is about before they step foot in the church. And obviously there has to be some correction sometimes with that, but I've had people their first Sunday, they'd never been in an Orthodox church before, and they say, I want to become a catechumen. I didn't know what a catechumen was the first time I walked into an Orthodox church, but these people already know, and they know that they want to become one. I slow them down a little bit, and I, you know, make sure that they have given some thought to what it is they're committing to, but this is a reality. So Orthodoxy is now on the map for people, and it's gotten to the point now where we have a lot of Protestant and Catholic apologists that are now attacking Orthodoxy, whereas it wasn't that long ago that they wouldn't even have bothered because they would have figured, well, who even knows what that is? But so many people are coming into the church that they feel like they need to respond because they're trying to stem the flow. Well, I think that they're only accelerating the flow because they're telling the people who didn't start watching Jay Dyer about Orthodoxy, and then they start watching these debates, and I think typically they're seeing, hey, these guys don't have anything. they can't respond to these Orthodox people that they're debating. So what is it that we need to do to try to take advantage of this wonderful opportunity that we've been given? Well, I think the key thing is that we need to be authentic in our faith. And it's not just a minor thing. For Father Seraphim Rose, how did he wind up going in the direction of Orthodoxy? Well, first he started going in the direction of Eastern religions. He was studying Buddhism, he was studying Hinduism, he was studying Taoism. But he was turned on to this by, in particular, Alan Watts, who was an apostate Anglican priest that decided he wanted to take a little bit of Buddhism here and a little bit of Taoism there and a little bit of Hinduism there, but only certain parts, not the authentic real deal. And then find some way to twist it into accommodating his hedonistic drug using lifestyle, if you go to Asian countries, you don't find Buddhists on the street that are trying to talk you into trying LSD and having, you know, free love. That's just not a thing. This is totally a Western invention. Father Seraphim Rose, being someone who was not satisfied with the surface level of these things, started digging into the legitimate text and the legitimate tradition, and he realized this guy's fake. But eventually he started to see there's still something missing, even though he valued greatly Chinese philosophy. He said that Chinese philosophy is the highest form of philosophy that a man can achieve without divine revelation, just based on reason and natural revelation. But as he started to reflect on the alternatives, you know, and he'd been raised Protestant, he came to a realization that the problem with Protestantism is it's fake too. It's taking little bits and pieces of ancient Christianity that you like, but not the whole thing. So when he started moving back in the direction of Christianity, he wanted the authentic thing. And that thing is, because of all the stuff that people are beginning to realize in society really is fake, that's the only thing that's going to really draw them. And if we're not authentic, then these people are going to go looking elsewhere, and they'll just be barking up the wrong tree if they look anywhere else. So we want to help them, but that requires that we really work on ourselves, and we make sure that our parishes are worshiping communities that observe the traditions of the church, and that we try to actually live out the Orthodox life. We want to make sure that we focus on quality before quantity. Quantity in terms of numbers of converts is very important, because each person is a soul. So we can never say, well, we don't want big numbers. I want big numbers. I want as many people as we could possibly get. But we can't water things down if we are going to be authentic. And that's on our parish level, but that also means on our family level. We need to make sure that we have very strong families. And if we go down the road of watering down the faith, then people are going to start thinking, well, this is just fake too. And unfortunately, we do have some people in the Orthodox Church that want to go down that road because they're embarrassed by aspects of the authentic Orthodox tradition, because it doesn't jive with the spirit of this world. And so they think they're helping the Orthodox Church by leading us into some sort of a modernist direction, and they're not, obviously, because that doesn't end well. That doesn't end with us having a true faith that unites us with God, which is the whole purpose of us having the church in the first place. If you're going to go down that road, just stay home on Sunday and watch TV and drink a cup of coffee, because it's either you're going to go for the real thing or just don't bother, but there's nothing in between those two points. We need to love the services, and particularly people who are coming into the church that discovered it online, there's a temptation for them to fall in love with Orthodoxy as sort of like a theoretical idea. But Orthodoxy is not lived out in theory. Orthodoxy is lived out in practice, and it does take a period of adjustment. I think it's important for us to let people know that you don't acquire an Orthodox mind instantaneously. You might be drawn to Orthodoxy, you might become convinced that Orthodoxy is the way, but you also do need to understand that there is a process that you go through, because you go through a worldview shift. If you don't know what that is, you can read about it in sociological text. But a worldview is the way we look at reality, and we all have one. Some worldviews are closer to a biblical worldview than others. Many people in our culture have sort of an empiricist worldview, but maybe they allow a little God on top. But basically, they only believe in what they can see. And so if you start talking about miracles, their natural reaction is, that's a bunch of crap. I don't believe that. They're, God doesn't work that way. God's just up there somewhere, and I hope maybe when I die I get to go be with him. But down here, it's just what I can see and touch, taste, and smell. That's not a biblical worldview. And when you convert to Orthodoxy, you have to realize that you're going to go through a worldview shift where you're going to start seeing the world differently, but it doesn't happen instantaneously. And the way you reprogram your brain to think is by reading the lives of the saints, reading the writings of the saints, reading the scriptures, and going to the services. You immerse yourself in the Orthodox tradition and just realize it's going to take a couple of years. But if you invest yourself in it, then you'll get there. One very important thing is that we need to make sure that our parishes are using a language that makes sense for the people that we're trying to reach. Now, if you have a very ethnic parish, there's nothing wrong with using a language other than English, even though you're in a country where that's one of the two official languages. But I know the dynamic's a little different in Canada and in Australia than it is in the United States. In the United States, it's always been a very welcoming country, but there is a great deal of pressure for you to assimilate. And so it's very rare for anyone to maintain a language other than English beyond the second or third generation. It almost always disappears. And I think that it's good to try to do that. In my own family, we've tried to do it with Chinese. My granddaughters can understand some Cantonese, but they don't understand Cantonese as well as their mother did or does. And so it's worth the effort, but most people are not going to take the effort. So if you have a parish that's, say, majority Greek people, makes sense to use Greek, particularly for the older generation. But if you're only using Greek, the problem you're going to run into is you're eventually going to lose your children and your grandchildren. It may be slower here because, again, the pressure to assimilate is not the same. But I know that when my wife and I met, she was going to a Chinese Baptist church. That's where we got married. But the two of us taught Sunday school class. And I could already tell these kids don't understand Chinese as well as their parents do. And the services were all in Chinese. Well, you know what? Chinese Baptists started to realize, hey, I guess we need to start doing about half our services in English, because otherwise we're going to lose our children. If you didn't care about converting anybody outside of your ethnic group to the Orthodox faith, you should use half English only because of your own children. If that's the only thing you were concerned about, just for the sake of your children, you should use at least half English. But we have a lot of other opportunities in North America, because you might not like the immigration policies of Canada. I don't blame you if you take that position. There's things about America's immigration policy that I'm not a big fan of, but the thing is, the reality is you have a missionary field that's moved to your country. And so from a Christian perspective, this presents us with a great opportunity, because it's not people that come to this country's fault that the immigration policy may not be the best thing for the country. These are all people created in the image of God, and you have an opportunity to reach them. And maybe in God's providence, he's allowed you to elect people who do these things contrary to maybe the best interests of the country, but it allows people to come here who can be exposed to the Orthodox faith and convert. And the best missionary to any country is someone who's a native speaker of the language of that country. Someone who has to learn that language as a second language is going to be a handicapped missionary. So if we can convert people in our own countries to the Orthodox faith, and some of them actually go back to their own countries as missionaries, they're going to be much more effective. And as Father has mentioned, we have a great opportunity, particularly in the United States, of doing missionary work in Spanish. But I don't limit it to that. I would like to see a Chinese Orthodox parish get started. But the thing is, for every one of these things to happen, you need people like a Father Seraphim Rose to step in the door, who is willing to be the bridge for other people who maybe don't have the same linguistic inclinations that they have. But if you look for the opportunities that God presents you with and take advantage of them, then you can start to build the infrastructure that was built for us in English for other language groups that don't have the same infrastructure right now. But it all can be done. We just need to support it and make sure that we're taking advantage of what opportunities God presents us with. It's also extremely important for you to be your parish to be welcoming of people who step in the door. And this is one thing a lot of people don't ever think about. Particularly if it's a very ethnic parish, you just figure, hey, the Russians are going to come to the Russian church. You don't have people out there trying to make them feel welcome. They're Russians, they'll feel welcome. Well, if a visitor comes in there who's never darkened the door of an Orthodox church, and nobody says anything to them, and then they walk out of that church, no one said anything to them before they left, the chances that they're ever going to come back are very slim. So in our parish, we have some people who keep their eyes out for visitors. We have a lady in our parish that's she's from Honduras. She's a Honduran Jew. And she and her all three of her sons converted to Orthodoxy, including her mother also converted too. She was actually the second one in the family to convert. Her oldest son was the first. And she is a very friendly person. She keeps her eyes out for everyone who walks in the door of the church. She makes sure that they feel comfortable, that they're told what they need to do during the services, that they know to stay after the service for the meal, that they get a chance to sit down and talk with me. Every parish needs a Rosa to do that, but you also need more than one, because Rosa's not always going to be there, so you need to have other people who are keeping their eyes out, and you also want to have a way that you're following up with people who visit. Plugging them in with the parish newsletter and other things to keep them abreast of what's going on in the parish, so that they know what's going on. And having trapas is something that is very important. Not every parish does it. You know, coffee hour is okay. But the thing is, if you are an Orthodox Christian, you've been fasting since midnight the night before because you want to take communion, and the liturgy's over, and all you've got is coffee and maybe some donuts or whatever. If you got kids, you can't stay very long because your kids are starving to death and they're going to be getting very cranky fast. You might be getting cranky with them. So you need to have a meal that's at least going to provide them with enough nutrition to where they're going to be able to stay. And so in our church, we always have a meal. We don't charge anything for it. We have a donation box out for it. We have three families, sometimes four families, that work together on a rotating schedule to provide the meal. And then we'll have people, we also do a Sunday school class after the liturgy for different age groups, including the adults. And then we have people just hanging out sometimes till 3 or 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. I've occasionally had to start playing that song, Closing Time, to start giving people the hint that it's time to go. I've got to lock the gate. Our gate has to be locked, and I can't leave people on the inside when I lock it. I think it's very important in terms that we have a reasonable approach to how we develop clergy, and to take someone who's a layman through the various processes to get them ordained as clergy, because we already don't have enough clergy to meet the needs of the people we already have, much less the people who are coming into the church. Now, Rocor is an exception to this, because Rocor has a lot more flexibility than other jurisdictions. We're the only jurisdiction that I know of that doesn't have a clergy shortage. And the reason for this is in large part because we have a pastoral school program that's online 100%. And that's actually merging with Holy Trinity Seminary, which is a traditional brick-and-mortar seminary. And so we're going to have tie those two together and get hopefully the best of both worlds out of it. But when I was studying to be a Protestant missionary, because when I repented of all the stupid stuff that I did when I was in high school and decided I wanted to live a Christian life, I thought, well, I ought to go into ministry. That's kind of a thing Protestants often think when they start getting serious about their faith. So I was actually studying to be a missionary, and I remember reading about how on the mission field, Protestants discovered a long time ago that you can't have a policy of sending everybody to seminary if you want to have enough clergy. Because the problem is, like, let's say you're a missionary in Papua New Guinea. You're out there in the bush trying to teach people the faith. You get some men that you say, okay, that's somebody who could potentially become a pastor, native speaker, that'll all be great. So if you then take that person and say, send them to Australia to the nearest brick and mortar seminary, what are the chances that guy's ever going to come back to Papua New Guinea? Because he's been living in the jungle, and now all of a sudden you're sending him to Australia, where maybe he gets married, starts having kids, he's got a nice first world apartment or whatever he's living in, and then you say, okay, now after you've sunk, maybe 6 years into an education and probably racked up some debt that you won't be able to pay if you're working in Papua New Guinea, let's have you go back to Papua New Guinea. He's probably going to say, no, I'm not going back. I like it right here. So they discovered, okay, well, you need to train ministers for Papua New Guinea in Papua New Guinea. Now, you probably want to look for the ones that have the most intelligence and have some of them go to brick-and-mortar seminaries so they can come back to Papua New Guinea and be the next generation of people who are training people there. But you're not going to have enough clergy if you're sending them all to Australia. You've got to train them there. Well, it's the same thing in the United States, because in many mission situations, the church, if you're starting a brand new mission, they can't afford to pay a clergyman a full salary. And so if you're going to take someone from Timbuktu, Texas, and then send them to Yankee land where the seminaries all are, and have them uproot his family, he's got a job in Timbuktu, but now you're taking him up to New York or Pennsylvania, and you're sending him to seminary, and he starts having a few kids, he might decide he want to go back to Timbuktu either, you know, because he's gets comfortable where he's at. And this is what tends to happen. So it's much better to train him where he's at, and the pastoral school accomplishes that because the studies are all online. There are some things you might go to in terms of a seminar or something like that, but the idea is you have an experienced priest who mentors him on the ground, and he learns how to do the practical side of being a priest, but he gets the academic side online, and he also doesn't have to quit his job, doesn't have to move, doesn't have to establish a new support network and then reestablish it 5 or 6 years later. One other thing that we need to be thinking about is that we need to make sure that our parishes are visible, and there's several things that we need to keep in mind. It used to be that if you were starting a new church, the model would be find a piece of property near the nearest high school or middle school, and you'll be very visible. People will drive by and they'll see, well, there's a church. That's not the reality anymore. People now are Googling Orthodox church near me. So what are they going to pull up when they type that if they live near you? Hopefully they're going to find a website. And your parish website should have a few basic things. And you'd be surprised at how many parish websites don't have these basic things. It ought to have your address. It ought to tell people how to get there. It ought to tell people when the services are. It ought to have a current schedule of services. And I can tell you, because I'm being the dean, I've looked at parish websites and seen a calendar that says, you know, 2021, and it's 2026. And you're thinking, okay, is this parish still open? You know, that's what most people would be thinking. Is it still open or did they close? So you want to have this basic kind of stuff, and you also want to have some things about the parish. What language do you use? Because if they know anything about Orthodoxy, they might know that they maybe use English, but maybe they don't. Maybe English is a thing for them, that they really want to make sure that the services are in English. Well, you ought to let people know. We use English, or we use English and Slavonic, or English and Greek, or whatever you do. But you want to let people know. And it doesn't hurt if you've got pictures of events, and maybe some link to a Facebook page where you're posting pictures or something like that. These various things give them some sign of life, and it gives them an opportunity to peek it in the door, so to speak, of the church, decide, is this something I really want to go to, or I don't want to keep looking at to see if there's another parish that looks more appealing. You also can do events. Like our parish used to do an icon exhibit. We did it for about 4 years, and we started seeing diminishing returns. It was a lot of work, so we haven't done one in a long time. But in the early stages of our parish, it was very effective, and we have an icon collector in our parish who has one of the best icon collections in the world, probably. And we had a ton of people come through the door. A lot of people joined the parish as a result, and we were able to advertise it. People stepped foot in the church for the first time. It was a very good way for us to get off the ground. But we periodically will do other things. Like one year we had Presbyteria Eugenia Constantina come and speak on the Book of Revelation. We had some people come in through the door that way. So if you do events that have an appeal that's not just services, because there are some people that are intimidated. I don't know anything about Orthodoxy. I don't want to walk into a service and have people think that I'm weird because I don't know what to do. But if you can get them to come in the door of the church on some non-threatening event, like a barbecue or something like that, then they can get a chance to meet people and then realize, hey, maybe these people are not going to bite my head off if I step in the door during a service. So, and you can also do community work, maybe volunteer with a food bank or something like that, but some way to let people know that you're there. I think it's very important for us to realize that the dynamics that we're seeing right now are not things that are necessarily going to continue on exactly as they are right now forever. So I think we need to make hay in the sunshine, as the saying goes, but we also need to be preparing for the possibility that this could change very radically. We could be under persecution. We could go back to something like the lockdowns because of COVID and being told we can't have church. And this, for us to prepare for persecution we need to make sure that we're working on our families and our parishes to build networks and community strength so we can support each other. But the really key thing is that you need to take the opportunity to learn about your faith now, to learn about the services, and buy books. Because St. Nectarius of Optina, he said this in the 1930s in Russia, or actually it was in the 20s, and he was talking about something that actually happened in the Soviet Union, but I think that we might see that too. Because right now you could buy anything you want very easily. You could order it on Amazon. The day might come when you're not able to get those things. And so you want to make sure that you have what you will need in your home if you can't get anything, and that you will be able to maintain an Orthodox life if you can't get to a parish. Hopefully the day will never come. You know, when Y2K was coming down the pike, I had enough people I knew who kind of scared me into thinking, you know, this could really be bad. I didn't think it was likely to be, but I thought, well, I don't want to have it be bad and then be wishing that I'd prepared. So we bought, you know, buckets of rice and put, you know, dry ice in them and stored them. Well, eventually we were able to eat them. We didn't waste anything. We also bought a propane cooker. We bought a few other things like that. We bought a water filter. Y2K came and went. Nothing happened. But you know what? 2009, Hurricane Ike came through and knocked the power out for 3 weeks. All that stuff that I bought to prepare for Y2K suddenly came in handy, and I was feeling pretty smart because we were able to eat hot food when all my neighbors were, you know, eating, you know, dry food and smelling that food that we were cooking over the fence, and we were sharing it with them because we didn't have the ability to keep it cold, so we were willing to give them the leftovers. But the thing is, when a hurricane is getting ready to hit, it's too late to prepare for the hurricane. It's too late to call the people to have your trim trees. You don't know about hurricanes up here, but in the Gulf Coast, it's really a big deal. I mean, maybe you could compare it with a really bad snowstorm. If you're not prepared for something like that, once it's happening, you can't get the stuff you need. And when a persecution comes, you're not going to have the time to prepare for that, so you need to be preparing for it now. And we want to also make sure that we're supporting missionary work whenever we can. Friendship is evangelism is something that every one of us can do, and that's just simply putting yourself in situations where you get to meet people who are not already part of your church. You could join a chess club. You might, you know, join a historical society. You might get into martial arts or something like that. But put yourself in a situation where you're going to be around people that are not already Orthodox, and if you get to know them, you're going to have a relationship with them where you can start talking to them about your faith, and they'll actually feel like you're someone that they can listen to. We need new trailblazers to be able to lay the groundwork for the missionary work that we want to do, and to some extent we all need to be trailblazers, because right now, as far down the road as we are compared to where we were, you know, 50 years ago in terms of evangelism, we have a long ways to go too, so we all need to be prepared to fill that void. As Christ said in the Gospels, right after he met the Samaritan woman, he said to his disciples, "Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white already to harvest." The harvest is there. We need workers in the field, and that means that each one of us needs to see what can we do. We can't all do the same things. Not everybody can be a priest. Not everybody can, you know, be a singer. But all of us can do something, and we need to start looking for things that we can do to help support our church. Because as any priest you ask can tell you, it takes a lot of things to make a service happen in the church. Somebody had to bake that prosperous. Someone had to clean that church. Someone had to pay to keep the lights on. I could go down this list for a very long time. There's a lot of little pieces that have to be there for you to be able to have a service. And everybody needs to figure out, what part of that am I here for to help make that happen? Because we all want to advance the kingdom of God. We want to find ourselves in the kingdom of God when the judgment comes. But we also want as many people around us. We want our loved ones. We want people that we don't know to be in the kingdom of God. And if we are faithful with what God has given us, then God, as he says in the Gospels, will put us in charge of a lot more things. And so let's be faithful with the small things now. Thank you. Any questions?
You'll find on your tables these yellow sheets. If you have questions, please pass them up to the front, and that way Father can read the question aloud. We don't have a sound system, so not everyone will hear if we just ask him from the floor. So if you have questions, pass them on up to the front, and Father can
What makes a good husband or wife? Well, I would say the key criteria would be an Orthodox Christian. That's the key thing. But, there's a lot that could be said on that subject beyond that. I think that it's good to get advice from people about a potential spouse. I often tell single men, because we have a little bit higher ratio of single men than we do single women, but I talk to them in other parishes as well, and what I advise them to do is, if you're looking for a wife, find the old women in the parish and be a nice young man around them and get to know them, talk to them, because old women have granddaughters and they have friends with granddaughters, and if they think that you're a decent guy, they're going to start trying to find somebody for you. So that's my advice. And I would imagine the same thing probably would be true of a woman looking for a husband, but you're probably not going to get any help from the men, so you need to talk to the old women too. That would be my advice. Why are there not as many women inquirers to the Orthodox Church? I've seen a lot more coming as time has gone by than I used to see. I had one year where I had two 17-year-old young ladies that both converted at the same time, and there was no one in their family, no boyfriend that was interested in Orthodoxy. They came on their own. I have a lady in my parish who is a captain of an oil tanker, came on her own, single woman. So it is happening. But what I would say is that women tend to follow the lead of the men in their lives, and so I think the women are going to be coming along, but it's when we were talking about this at the dinner, because Father David was talking about the advice that he had gotten from his priest about dealing with his wife, because he was very much interested in Orthodoxy, his wife not so much for quite some time. I had the same experience. And the thing is, women by their nature are not as quick to change their faith, which is in some ways a good thing. If you think about the women who were at the cross and went to the tomb on the Pascha morning, that's because there's this instinctive loyalty that women tend to have, and that's a good thing. But if you allow them an opportunity to start establishing relations with people in your parish, they can start to imagine themselves becoming a part of this community, because they think more relationally than they do logically. You can't typically argue a woman into the Orthodox Church. They might have questions. It's not to say that they have no theological issues that they might want to resolve, but it's going to be much more of a relational question than it's going to be for a man. And so men and women are different, if you didn't notice that. And that's what I've observed. And I do think that if you are a man who has a wife or a girlfriend that you're trying to bring along, being patient is really the key. I tried arguing my wife into the Orthodox Church, and I discovered very quickly that it wasn't going to have the desired effect. My mother had probably more success arguing my wife into the Orthodox Church, because she moved in with us and was constantly criticizing the Orthodox Church, and my wife, out of her instinctive loyalty to her husband, started defending me. And so she probably helped more than I did in that respect. Can you speak about how monasteries and monastic life plays into the Orthodox mission work? Can Orthodoxy have a rooted future without the growth of monasteries? I think that monasteries are really essential. And that's another piece of that infrastructure that's been laid in North America that we didn't have before. We had some monasteries, but we didn't have very many. And now, thanks to the Elder Ephrem, we have 20 new monasteries that are very impressive. Monasticism really is the backbone of a local church. If you have a local church with no monasticism, that's certainly not a sign of health. What is the best way to explain orthodoxy to a Protestant who believes in predestination? I think that probably the best way to explain it to a Protestant is, do we believe in predestination as an Orthodox Christian? Yes, we do, because the new St. Paul talks about in the New Testament how whom he foreknew, he also predestined. So we believe that there is such a thing as predestination. The difference is that Calvinists believe that before, you know, God did anything, before he created any, even the universe, he'd already decided who was going to go to heaven and who was going to go to hell. The thing is, in the wisdom of Sirach, I believe it is, or maybe it's the wisdom of Solomon, but it says, his gaze spans the ages. So we believe that God is not circumscribed by time. So God, it's not as if God is looking into the future because he got a crystal ball and he can see, okay, well, so-and-so is going to go to hell and this guy is going to go to heaven. God is already in the future and he's beyond the future. He's beyond time. So God already knows exactly what's going to happen. But it's not that he determines it. God interacts with time, and he works out his will, but we don't believe that people go to hell because God just decided that he didn't like them, and that, you know, for mysterious reasons, it somehow adds to his glory that he's going to go to hell. So I think it's a lot of it has to do with just an improper understanding of what a God's omniscience means. And the other thing that I would say is that this idea of predestination is based on St. Augustine to a large extent, but it's actually based on views that went beyond anything Augustine ever said. And St. Augustine, before he became a Christian, was a Manichaean. Manichaeans don't believe in, or didn't believe in, free will. They believed that everything was determined. And I think that what happened in his case was is that he did what I talked about this on Friday. It's easy for a convert to the faith to fall back into old lines of argument when you're in a pinch, because it's what comes natural to you. And he was arguing with a real heretic, Pelagius, who thought that you could be saved without God's grace, but he wound up making arguments that were very Manichaean, and so I think that he went off the rails. But even St. Augustine never said that Adam was predestined to fall. That's what Calvin believes, though, that God already decreed the fall, and that Adam had really had no say in the matter, and that's just not something that an Orthodox Christian could possibly accept. So I think that encouraging them to read Orthodox commentaries on the scriptures would be helpful, you know, from the mainstream fathers. There's good articles written by people who write apologetic material for Calvinists. There's a guy whose name escapes me, but it's like the Orthodox Bridge, and it's a blog dedicated entirely to responding to Calvinists. And so I think I would encourage you to point people in that direction. How can we show up as authentic Orthodox Christians in a practical way in the world? Well, it's making sure that you're actually living out the faith and not trying to live some sort of a half-Orthodox life and doing like this Alan Watts guy that Father Seraphim encountered, where you're taking a little bit of this because you like that, a little bit of that. I like the incense. I like the singing. But this asceticism and fasting, I don't like that, so I'll just leave that off of my own version of orthodoxy. Well, that's not how it works. The Orthodox Church is a package deal. You either take it or you leave it. Did we communicate with the Chinese government about opening more church in the Chinese mainland? I know that the Russian government has and the church have tried to get some churches open, and I think they've had some success with that. I know there are seminarians in Russia that are being trained, but it's not had a huge impact yet, but that can change. You talk about a mission field coming to your country. Right now in Russia, China is coming to Russia. I was there in 2007. I didn't see very many Chinese people. I went again in 2019, there were Chinese people everywhere, because right now with the sanctions, you don't have a lot of people coming from Western Europe or the United States, but Chinese people have good trade relations with Russia, and they realize, hey, our money goes a long way in Russia. So they're coming to Russia for vacations. I was there in February, which is not prime vacation time in Moscow. And we went to the St. Sergius Trinity Lavra, and there were four tour groups of Chinese tourists that were there. And they had like regimental banners so that people from a distance could keep track of which tour group they were a part of. And there were signs all over the Lavra that were written in Chinese that said, be quiet, be quiet, be quiet. Because these people weren't used to being in church, so they would come into a church in the middle of the service and start snapping pictures and talking. But what an opportunity. And they actually had some Chinese books available for them. But I talked to the dean of the Moscow Theological Academy, because I was with a friend who knew him. And I said, you know, you need to be doing more for this. I mean, you need to get someone who can speak Chinese and start, you know, guiding these tours through the Lavra, making sure that you have lots of books available for these people, because we don't have to send missionaries to China when you have that many Chinese people come into your country and you can teach them about the faith in a context where they see these big, beautiful churches, which will take a long time to build in China. So you want to take advantage of the circumstances that you have. Let's see. You stress the importance of Americans, Canadians being accommodated to resources and services being in English. Are there or should there be benefits of the opposite? And if so, what advice do you have for converts connecting with the cradle of worlds? Well, I actually meant to say something along that line, so I'm glad the question was asked. Because you do have converts that come into the church and they can see people who were raised in the church as being the problem. Particularly like if they're in a parish where there's a lot of a language that they don't understand, or they see some members of the group, maybe they're not as pious as they think that they ought to be. But the thing is, the converts need people who are rooted in the faith. Because otherwise they wind up becoming squirrely, inauthentic people, because they don't know. There's so many things that you don't know when you come into the church. And so even people who you might think, this person's not as pious as they ought to be, don't judge them. Find out what you can learn from them, because they know more about the faith than you do, even if they're not living it as well as they should. So spend time with them. I converted in a parish where there was just a handful of Russian people and everybody else was English-speaking convert. The services were almost all in English. They did a little bit of Slavonic, which I later became thankful for, because I spent 3 months in Jordanville where it was all in Slavonic and Russian. And then I moved back to Houston, and the only real core parish was this parish where, you know, at least half of any service was in Slavonic in most cases, and sometimes it was like maybe 80 or 90% Slavonic. And we were surrounded by, you know, mostly Russian people. But in retrospect, I'm very thankful for that experience, because being around that people in that parish, which I would not have picked if that was the first parish I visited, I probably would have said, okay, well, that's not for me. I would not have picked it. But in that parish, we got to meet a woman who was on the clerical staff of St. John of Shanghai in San Francisco. And she was just one of the most amazing people that I've ever met in my life. But, you know, there wasn't a sign out front that said, meet someone who knew St. John, come to St. Vladimir here in Houston. Well, you wouldn't meet her if you didn't come there. And there were other people like that I got to know that I learned so many things from. And I also learned how to read the rubrics in Slavonic, because that was all they had available, and I wound up being the choir at the vigil in many cases. Now I translate the Jordanville calendar in English and make that available to other people, which would never have happened if I was not in a situation where I had to learn how to read that. So God in His providence puts us where we need to be, so we should always, even if we're not in the situation that we think is ideal, we should always be thankful for what God has given us and assume that God is trying to teach us something. And definitely, if you're a convert, you want to know people who've been Orthodox all their life and their generations of Orthodox Christians and their families, because you're going to learn a lot of things that you will not learn. If you're in an all-convert parish, I can tell you, from having seen parishes like that, there are weird things that go on in those places because people don't know. It's not that they intend to be weird, it's that they don't know. And but if you're around, if there's enough, I think it's really good to have a mixed parish where you have at least a good, you know, 30% of the parish that's been born in the church. And then you have lots of converts that have the zeal, because you have the zeal without knowledge, and then you have the knowledge without zeal in many cases. You add them together, and then you get a balance on both sides. If immigrants lose their native language in one or two generations, what is the future of Spanish language parishes? Well, the thing is, there are parts of the United States where it's probably a lot easier to maintain Spanish because you hear it everywhere you go. So it's probably going to continue to be a thing in the United States. But I can tell you there are lots of people who come from Hispanic backgrounds that do lose the language. Our priest in Corpus Christi, he's Mexican. His wife is Mexican. He doesn't speak Spanish very well. His cousin does, but he doesn't. And I think that's just the natural direction if you don't live in an area where you're hearing it all the time. But if you lived along the border of Mexico and Texas, you there probably will never lose Spanish in that area because there's so many people that speak it there. Do Orthodox Christians have a duty to surrender their firearms when our government bans them? We have a Fifth Amendment in the Constitution of the United States that gives you the right to not answer a question.
So, I have a right to verify.
It may happen that many people in my parish will have a boating accident where their firearms were lost and they won't be able to return them to the government. I have no guns, but my wife, on the other hand, has a couple. How can you suggest priests from ethnic parishes to serve in English? A lot of these priests say that people want their service in their national language. Well, the thing is, I wrote an article on this subject that's on my blog. As a matter of fact, I think it might still be the last article on my blog to read. But I wrote it, I told the story. I do the Akathist for the Repose of the Departed for my non-Orthodox family on a somewhat regular basis. And there's a line in there where you're praying for those who have no one among the believing to pray for them. And I know a lot of old Russians that I knew at St. Vladimir who have had no one among the believing to pray for them at the end of their lives because... not because they didn't try to raise their children and grandchildren in the church, but because they were taking them to a church where everything was in Slavonic and Russian and their children just didn't grow up understanding anything. And when they got old enough to say, I'm not going, they stopped. And it wasn't that, I don't think there was any bad intentions on their part. It's not their fault that they didn't realize that America is a very welcoming place, but the push to speak English exclusively is so powerful that people lose their language. And it's also not their fault that they didn't know that the public schools are very anti-Christian, and so their kids were getting bombarded with stuff that leads them away from faith, period, and they didn't understand anything when they came to church. Well, that's a bad combination. So again, I would say those priests should be trying to do at least some English in their parishes just for the sake of their own kids, not to mention the missionary potential that might result from them doing, you know, say, half English. But just for the sake of their own kids, they need to do that. What are your thoughts about the desire among converts to live in close community, i.e. starting Orthodox land movements, Orthodox villages? I think that that's a great idea. You know, it needs to be thought through, and you don't want to establish a commune, you know, where you're all living on the same property, because that's probably not going to end well. But the idea of encouraging people to all buy their own property in close proximity to each other and have a parish that's the center of a community, I think that's wonderful. As a matter of fact, that's kind of what birthed this mission we started in New Waverly, Texas, an hour to the north of us. We had people who want to see that happen. So I hope that it does develop in that direction. In your extensive experience with inquirers, what do most of them struggle with to understand about the Orthodox faith, the biggest hurdles? Well, I know from my own background, the biggest hurdles that I had were the Virgin Mary, because I was raised in a very anti-Catholic context. The Church of the Nazarene today, you would not know that back when I was a kid, they had such an anti-Catholic attitude, but that's how I was raised, and so we were taught to believe that Roman Catholics were just idolaters, and that when they died, they just took them down to the basement, put them in a chute, and that they went straight to hell, you know, when they died. And then, when I discovered the Orthodox faith, I began to see, hey, I guess Catholics didn't make all this stuff up after all, you know. But they're a little off on some stuff. But I began to see, okay, I guess it wasn't just pagans, you know, infiltrations of the Catholic Church. But the Virgin Mary was a big one. The veneration of the saints, prayers for the dead, the ever virginity of the Virgin Mary was an issue, and. I think the Eucharist maybe was at first an issue. Was the Eucharist really the body and blood of Christ? But I think that was one of the first items to get scratched off the list, because you read the Fathers of the Church and it's so abundantly clear that they believe that the Eucharist was the body and blood of Christ. Prayers for the dead was another easy one. But when it came to the Virgin Mary, I told the story this morning during the questions and answers, but I had a friend that was talking to me about this old woman that was the wife of a retired professor at the college that I went to. And he told me, you know, if you ever have a need for prayer, you need to go to that woman, because she's a woman of prayer. When she prays, God listens. She's got a hotline to God. Talk to her. And I thought, well, if there's ever a woman that had a hotline to God, it would have to be the Virgin Mary. And so that was the day that question got resolved for me. But it took time, because your brain as a Protestant is wired to think in a certain way. And when I saw Orthodoxy the first time, I thought, now there's some real worship going on here. But at first I thought, it's cool, but I don't think so. But I kept coming back, because I thought, well, I probably at least ought to understand it better, because it's an important church that I didn't know much about before. And then gradually I started thinking, I could maybe be Orthodox if I could get past these issues. And then eventually I became convinced. And then I decided I probably ought to tell my wife about it. So that was when her journey began. A mission without a decent choir is torture. What are some steps to remedy a situation like this? Well, I think that that is one area that we need to work on, is helping people to learn how to sing their way through the services. And the best way is obviously if you have more established parishes with a functional choir that start training people who then help to get mission started. And there are lots of things that you can do on your own. I mean, in my case, I'm a functional musical illiterate. I can't read music, but I do know how to sing, so I can memorize melodies in my head. Well, I was singing in the choir at the church in Oklahoma. When we got to Houston to go to St. Vladimir's, there were a bunch of old Russians that were holding down the fort at the vigil. But when they saw that my wife and I were coming on a regular basis, it was as if they said, Lord, now lettest thou thy servants depart in peace. And they stopped coming except on big feasts, because they were old. And we're talking about people in their 80s. And so we suddenly found ourselves as the choir at vigil. And I didn't know the tones. I knew, I had heard them. I could sing them when the choir director, started it. But I didn't know how to retrieve the tones. So what I did was I got some cassette tapes at the time of people going through the tones, and I memorized them. I started working on one tone at a time. Next week, going to be tone two. I'm going to learn the Stikirin tone two between now and Saturday night. I might not be able to do the other tones that week, but I'm going to do that one. And then I cycled through the eight tones. Well, I'm going to learn the Triparian tone two next time tone two comes around. Well, now I'm going to learn the Perkamenon tone two and the Irmos tone two. It took me a while, but I eventually got them all down to where I could sing my way through a service. And I think we need people who are willing to do that. You don't have to be a great musician. You just have to be able to carry a note on key and be willing to spend some time learning the music. I think that's the last question. All right.